This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney Jay Carson. Hey, Jay.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay. So I guess I should start off this week's show with a little bit of a disclaimer to everyone. It's been a rough week for me. We are big dog fans here at the Baranowski household. We've always had three or four. And if you're a dog owner, you know there comes a time, regrettably, where you have to make some hard decisions and dogs get old and sick. And our oldest dog, Bertram, is at that point, and it's been rough, and he's not going to be with us probably that much longer. And so it's been a challenging week for me. And so, but anyway, I am here, and I am grateful for the distraction and the opportunity to talk with you, Jay. And I got to say, through this week, a lot of the fans and supporters have also been, it's been great interacting with all of you guys. So thank you so much. All right. So with that out of the way, there is actually one more thing I wanted to mention is we have a new yearly Patreon supporter. You can do that, be a supporter for an entire year pledge, and you actually save 10% off of
that's really taking a gamble.
You know, it kind of is. But since we've been around since 2015, it's probably a reasonably safe. But why would
I'm just saying that, you know, one of those, you know, you can't you're committing yourself for a whole year. It's not a
Well, we do actually offer money back.
Month.
We do offer money back guarantees. We can do refunds. So if you're worried about that gamble, hey, We've got you covered, I guess is what I'm saying. But anyway, we do appreciate our new yearly Patreon supporter who has the fantastic Patreon name of I Like Politics Guys, Especially Jay. So there,
Jay, that is a fantastic name.
Jay, did you do an anonymous play? Or
I did not. It might be like my mom or something.
There you go. Pseudonymous. I don't know. Anyway, but thank you so much. We appreciate your support very much. All right. So this week we will open with Super Tuesday. And honestly, this week's Super Tuesday presidential primary, I'm going to be a little bit different on this and say it was highly unusual. And what I mean by that is it was highly unusual in that it was, I believe, the least competitive Super Tuesday ever. I mean, in a way, not surprising, given that we have an incumbent running against really a pseudo incumbent here. And that's pretty unusual for sure. Now, Nikki Haley did manage to pick up 48 delegates and win Vermont, but you know, Donald Trump won the other 14 states and earned 789 delegates. And that, of course, led Nikki Haley to suspend her campaign. Now, Jay, we were fairly certain what was going to happen. And sure enough, it happened. So what are your thoughts?
Well, there isn't a whole lot of analysis or light that I feel like I can add to this that hasn't been said already or wasn't sort of the conventional wisdom. I think you're right in that this is a little bit of a weird Super Tuesday, but it's also a little weird in that we essentially have two incumbents challenging each other and you don't have a hard fought primary. If anything, maybe the surprise would have been a couple months ago, right? That there is no real Trump challenger emerging. Something else that strikes me, and this goes back a couple weeks, right? Not essentially just Super Tuesday, but you know, there was sort of a theory, and I was to some extent a proponent of it, that Trumpism was something more than Trump. And I don't know that it is anymore. Excuse me. Sorry. I've got a and you can edit that out. But, you know, there was sort of a conventional wisdom about a year or so ago that someone like a Ron DeSantis, for example, might offer all of the, you know, Trumpian policies, some of the Trumpian swagger, but without the Trump baggage. And that never seemed to materialize, right? And that seemed to be the lane that would have been most likely to result in a serious challenge. So what was left was the more traditional Republican lane, which Nikki Haley occupied, and I think occupied as well as anyone could. But the numbers just were not there, and were not going to be there. So,
and that was the sort of alternative that you are actually, I believe, hoping for, right? That
yeah,
sort of
yeah.
thing. Though, of course,
my own personal, yeah, my own sort of aesthetic preferences and some kind of policy preferences. Yeah.
Yeah. As a matter of policy, you tend to prefer people who actually have some sort of respect for rule of law and executive limits on power and that sort of thing.
I do. Yes. Yeah,
there you go. All right. So I guess I'll say one point I'll make is that the fact that Haley stayed in this long means that she's the only Trump alternative with pledged delegates. And if something should happen, and I'm not saying anything will, I don't expect anything to happen, but of course we're dealing with an elderly gentleman who's not exactly in the best of health and doesn't exactly take very good care of himself, things can happen. And if something were to happen, whether it's health-wise or legal system-wise, I think Nikki Haley could make a case better than any other Republican to be sort of the next person to look to in some sense. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
So that gets into a really weird situation, doesn't it? I mean, it also depends sort of when it happens, how it would happen. Obviously, at a convention, I think it would be difficult, even for Nikki Haley, saying, look, I've got these many delegates, you know, I should be the nominee. I think that's tough. I don't know, because we would sort of be in uncharted territory, I think, if you were to have, you know, depending on if something happens before or after the convention. And again, this is, you know, wild speculation. You know, I don't know. And I personally have not given it that much thought about how that works procedurally. And I don't know that there is a process, right? I think it might just be kind of general acclamation, and the party can pick its own candidate however it wants, and you could have some legal wrangling over that. But no, I think Nikki Haley might have a claim, but I don't see that she would have necessarily the support to get that, you know, what would essentially have to be kind of a vote by acclamation.
And so at this point, Trump Biden, the rematch is all but official. And though, Jay, you wanted to mention one other Super Tuesday result.
Jason Palmer won the American Samoan caucus on Super Tuesday, defeating President Biden. Out of 91 ballots cast in the territory's caucus, Palmer won 51 and Biden 40. So to say this is over, Mike, is really a stretch.
So maybe we're talking about then a Haley Palmer unity ticket. I know that No Labels is looking right for a unity ticket, and I think there you go. You have Haley right. with the DC who won a primary where there actually were a significant number of voters at DC and then Vermont, and so we have you know, what do you think? Haley Palmer.
So yeah, and if for those who are keeping count, Palmer now has three delegates, and he posted on X, which we all know what it used to be called, that Washington D.C. is long overdue for a president who will be an advocate for American Samoa. Hard to disagree with that.
It is rare that we see American Samoa issues come up to the forefront, and I don't think we've ever talked about American Samoa issues. So he's certainly right about that. There you go. All right. Well, Jason,
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry for that digression. But yes, I would agree. Otherwise, this Jason Palmer notwithstanding, this looks to be a Trump Biden rematch, as everyone had been sort of predicting for about the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's at this point, it's definitely Donald Trump's race to lose. I mean, he has leads in all of the critical battleground states. He even leads in the national polling. And I'm skeptical that Donald Trump will end up winning the popular vote in November. These days, Republicans don't win the popular vote. I mean, it's been a while. But I think that the Biden camp's sort of views, hopes, claims that their guy's going to come out on top once voters are reminded of the chaos of the Trump administration, or when the general election campaign kicks in the gear, when people start feeling the real effects of a much more solid economy. Maybe that's right, but it's starting to feel a little bit like sort of whistling past the graveyard at this point. Though, again, it is still early. And it's weird, Jay, because based on the fundamentals, you'd expect Biden to win. You take the candidates out of this and just look at that. But when I think about that, I don't know really how much of a guide history or fundamentals are, because we do have these very unusual circumstances. We've already mentioned the quasi-incumbent status of Trump and Biden's age. And so I don't know. I guess one interesting thing about the economy especially is there was a recent CBS News poll found that 65%, almost two-thirds of Americans, remember the economy under Trump being good, compared to around 38%, giving the current economy under Biden sort of a positive view, a positive assessment. And that's a big deal, right? And it seems to me that when I think about that, the big difference is inflation, right?
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. And inflation is down, but inflation was lower under the pre-COVID, in the Trump years. And so I think when the voters think about the Trump years and the economy, they think about mainly that pre-COVID period where the economy was humming along. It was the kind of a really good point in the business cycle. Now, how much credit does Donald Trump get for that? Well, it doesn't really matter. It's the perception. And the economy's pretty good now, but price stability is such a big deal. And inflation, you know, once those prices bump up, it's not like they bump back down. And it's not just overall inflation. It's things like overall inflation right now, I think, is 3.1%. But inflation for what's the category called food eaten out of the home, which is what a lot of Americans do a lot of the time, it's like over 5%. And so those are the things that are sticky in voters' minds. And so even if the stock market's great and GDP growth is great and wage growth is actually outpacing inflation and has been for the last year, people see those prices and they stick in their head. And so it makes sense to me that Biden isn't winning on this issue. And I, think he's in really big trouble. Jay?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with all of that. I think you're diagnosing it exactly correctly. These are things that people feel in their pocketbook every day, and as you said, the wages, real income wages now seem to be rising, but there's still if you're looking, depends on what snapshot you're looking at. If you look at have they made up ground from where they were, when they were declining over the last year or two. I don't think we're there yet, right? So people still aren't feeling that. And as you mentioned, yes, inflation is down, but prices are not, which is to be expected.
Yeah. So in all of that, I mean, would you then agree with my overall assessment that it looks like it's Donald Trump's race to lose at this point?
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing I would add is that there's potential even bigger problem for Biden is the place where Trump is winning. It seems to be with independents. He has a solid lead and in swing states. So that makes it all the more troubling.
And again, it is early. And of course, a whole lot of things can change. But we, at this point,
right,
this is kind of
people might learn some unflattering information about Trump that would really turn them off to him.
All right. Well, another thing I wanted to mention is that following Super Tuesday, Mitch McConnell, Senate Republican leader, endorsed Donald Trump. He said, "It's abundantly clear that former President Trump has earned the requisite support of the Republican voters to be our nominee. It should come as no surprise as the nominee, he will have my support." During his presidency, we worked together to accomplish great things for the American people, including tax reform that supercharged our economy and a generational change of our federal judiciary, most importantly, the Supreme Court. And I just want to remind listeners that this is the man, the same man who in February of 2021 said former President Trump's actions preceding the riot were a disgraceful dereliction of duty. There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. It was obvious that only President Trump could end this. He was the only one who could. He did not act swiftly. He did not do his job. He watched television happily as the chaos unfolded. He kept pressing his scheme to overturn the election, even after it was clear to any reasonable observer that Vice President Pence was in serious danger, even as the mob carrying Trump banners was beating cops and breaching perimeters. Their president sent a further tweet attacking his own vice president. And this is the man who will have his support in 2024. Jay, how do you square these two statements?
Well, I guess the way you square them is you say, well, he's the nominee of the party. What else are you going to do? Right. And that is kind of what McConnell said. There was something to it of the kind of the, you know, the critics agree it's 2 hours long. Kind of review, right?
I disagree. I disagree with that.
Well, yes, he does have the established the votes. But
I think you're wrong about that. If he would have just said he would have just said that he has earned the requisite support to be our nominee, and he would have stopped there, his silence would have been telling. He did not have to say it should come as no surprise that his nominee he will have my support. He didn't have to say that. That goes beyond the movie is 2 hours long. That is actually
because you are surprised he has a support. Yes.
No, I'm not. I'm not at all surprised. I believe that when it comes to I will not say that Mitch McConnell is a man entirely without principle. His principle is Republican power. But aside from that, as far as I can tell, his career is marked by fairly clear lack of any sort of principle. In any meaningful way. And that's not just because he's a Republican. There are plenty of Republicans with principles, Ronald Reagan, Thomas Massey, a whole bunch of people, but not Mitch McConnell. And he had a chance to say something by saying nothing, and he chose not to do it. And that's just Mitch McConnell. And I'm not disappointed with him anymore because that's just who he is. And there you go. But I think I'll say this. I feel like McConnell, the most charitable way of reading it, he's making the calculation that the potential harm that Trump might do, almost certainly harm he might do, is outweighed by the possibilities for positive things, like particularly, I'd say, judicial appointments, because there's almost certainly going to be a Republican Senate majority. That I feel very certain of that. The two oldest justices on the Supreme Court, Thomas and Alito. I mean, by the end of the next presidential term, Clarence Thomas is going to be 80. Alito's going to be 78. The idea of being able to replace those two guys and everyone else on the court is significantly younger than those two would really cement in a majority for even longer. And I think McConnell's kind of looking to that essentially. But I don't know that that would. I don't think his endorsement, certainly or lack thereof, hardly matters at this point, right? I think he's become a non-entity in the party. But that's kind of, if you want to look at it strategically, I think maybe that's the way he looks at it. And I bring that up because I think that's how a lot of Republicans, to my great disappointment, are going to look at it and say, "Well, yeah, Trump can be managed. It won't be that bad." The Democratic order won't collapse, but in the meantime, we're going to get judges and maybe some policies that we'd like better than under a second Biden term. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, that's not an irrational calculation. I mean, essentially, he's making the calculation of, look, Trump may be terrible, but Biden would be worse.
Yep. And I think there's a question voters have to ask themselves. I mean, Republican voters have to ask themselves who like it all this policy. Well, how far is too far? I would be willing, I won't speak for you, Jay, but I would be willing to bet that if Donald Trump was found to be credibly accused and convicted of, let's say, rape, just as an example of something that would not seem to be terrifically out of character, and you felt that that was actually the case, you would not be able to support him.
I think that's correct. Yeah.
Right. So there are, I mean, my point is that there are lines, and then the question you have to ask is that, well, I think there are maybe.
Well, no, let me, so we're saying, far the line from Stripes, convicted? No, never convicted. No, but I'm thinking back to if that were the test, what's to be made of all the Democrats who supported Bill Clinton? You know, in the face of the Broderick.
Maybe rape is a bad example because we're talking about a personal criminal sort of thing. But let's say that you knew that Donald Trump would.
They got video of him robbing a bank, right? Yeah.
Let's say it's unquestioned that he is. So let's take Bill Clinton out of this. Let's just say that I guess the larger question I'm asking you is there any sort of personal criminal moral failing so great that it should disqualify a candidate for office in your mind, even if you believe that the policy repercussions of having that candidate in office will be better for the things you believe in? In other words, is it always a case that the means justify the ends?
I would say yes or no, because I think the problem you always have, right, is the compared to what, right? And not necessarily even policy stuff. You know, should we ally ourselves with Joseph Stalin? He's probably one of the most horrible, vicious people, terrible people in the history of the world. Well, but you're allying him against, you know, well, he's your ally against Hitler. So you have to say, well, all right, well, you know, you look at the balance of harms there. And in that case, you would say, well, listen, it's better. And keep in mind, historically, there were people who disagreed with that calculation. But so I think it's tough to say, is there one thing that would disqualify that I would say absolutely never vote for that person? And I suppose it's always a difficult because you're sort of like, well, compared to what? That said, I mean, I think I've said a number of times that given his actions after the election, I find it really difficult to vote for him. Right. So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from, that I would say, you know, his actions on January, I would agree with what Mitch McConnell said on January 6th about January 6th.
And I guess right now, and that kind of leads into the polling.
But one other point, and I guess this is because I'm always sort of the opinion of, well, who cares what I think, right? Why should someone care how I think, vote, anything like that? But I think what's interesting from a strategic point is McConnell making this statement now, making it quickly, making it early, so that takes it just takes him out of the equation.
Well, I guess, right? But I feel like he was out of the equation anyway. I mean, he's pretty much been read out of the party.
I don't know. I mean, otherwise there would be, you know, talk up through the convention of, well, he still hasn't been endorsed by Mitch McConnell. He still hasn't, you know, where's Mitch McConnell? And, you know, every day, you know, Mitch McConnell being peppered, well, will you endorse that sort of thing? It takes it out off the table.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. But gotcha. You're not,
so
you're
from
not
a,
arguing
from a strategic
that,
standpoint. Right. I think it's, yeah.
But it's not exactly, it's, so it was more along the lines of, you think Mitch McConnell just not wanting to have to answer the question or being peppered.
He's removing himself as a potential distraction.
Gotcha.
He doesn't have to deal with the, what the press would be doing, right? Sort of, you know, trying to goad him into a fight with Trump up through the election.
Right. Gotcha. I see what you're saying. All right. Well, why don't we move on?
So individuals, personal scruples be damned. I'm saying that's the strategery here.
Sure. Well, why don't we move on to another Trump-related story, because it's all about Donald Trump, it seems like these days. It's just the way he'd want it, I would expect. But a Supreme Court ruling that was unanimous, but not a unanimous agreement. Jay, why don't you lead us off on this one?
So yeah, the case was Trump versus Anderson, if you're scoring at home, and decided last Monday, wherein a unanimous Supreme Court in a per curiam unsigned opinion essentially said that the overruled the Colorado Supreme Court, holding that Donald Trump can in fact appear on the Colorado ballot. Now the reasons for this decision are a couple, right? This was brought under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which would bar insurrectionists. The majority essentially agreed on the question of, look, a single state cannot make this decision because it would result in chaos, right? A patchwork of ballots and candidates, some candidates allowed some states, some candidates allowed others. The majority delved more deeply into Section 3 and what the remedy and the enforcement mechanism should be for Section 3, specifically saying, look, a state does not have the constitutional authority to enforce Section 3. It would have to be some sort of act by Congress to do so. And they pointed to statements of justices at the time and also congressional actions from the 1870s and the Enforcement Act, which was geared to enforce just this. And, you know, the idea, of course, as everyone knows, was to prevent Confederates from holding federal office. So,
although I'll point out that while that may have been the intent, the language was not specifically focused just on Confederates. And so if they wanted to limit it just to that, they would have used that language and they didn't.
Right. Well, I think they could fairly say, look, these are the only insurrectionists we know of and we're talking about that we've really had to deal with lately. There was a sort of concurrence in result only with the three liberal justices arguing that the majority went too far and did not have to delve into the enforcement mechanism of Section 3. Rather, it would have been sufficient simply to say a state does not have the authority to bar someone from the ballot or to essentially decide who's going to be a president. And so that was sort of a little bit of a discordant note in what otherwise would have been, I think, a triumph of agreement. And I think you and I would agree common sense on that question.
We both agreed at the time that states should not be able to bar presidential candidates for the ballot for all the reasons we talked about back then. One note I'll add to what you mentioned with the concurrence. There was a concurrence by the three liberal justices on the court, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. But in a separate concurrence, also Justice Barrett, hardly a liberal justice, said that this didn't require us to address the complicated question whether federal legislation is the exclusive vehicle through which Section 3 can be enforced. So she actually agreed with Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. So four.
But she also said we should try to get along.
Well, sure, but
on a question like this, yeah.
And I want to point out in the concurrence, I thought it was interesting that Sotomayor, who wrote the concurrence, started by essentially calling out the Chief Justice. John Roberts, she actually cited his concurrence in Dobbs, where Chief Justice Roberts wrote, if it is not necessary to decide more to dispose of a case, then it is necessary not to decide more. And saying, hey, well, yeah, what about it, John? Because the point being is that if they had convinced Roberts to follow his own, what they believe his own logical reasoning consistency, then this would have been a narrower opinion, because Justice Barrett would have signed on to that, as would obviously have Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. And I guess, to me, I think that those four justices are absolutely right. I mean, they say there's no federal action involved here whatsoever, that this was a sensitive case, as they say, crying out for judicial restraint, and that the court abandoned judicial restraint here. And it seems to me that this is pretty clearly an opportunity for the court to have shown some restraint, and the court decided not to show restraint. I think this was the correct call, but a bad opinion.
Disagree on a couple of reasons. One, the question presented really was How does Section 3 work? What's the
no? It wasn't. That was not the question presented. Okay. That's just factually wrong. The question presented was whether a state can remove a president. So
sure, under Section 3.
Right, but that's not. So that was the question presented. You just said that the question presented was not what. Sorry, the question presented was just that, and they could have answered that question and been done with it. But they chose not to do that. They chose to interpret. They chose to interpret Section 5 and Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, because those two things are in working together, in a way that I would argue, number one, they didn't have to decide the case, and that I think is indisputable. They did not have to address. Now you can disagree with me about whether or not they should have done that, but I would think you would not. It would be hard for me to understand how you could disagree with me about the fact that they did not necessarily have to do that. That was a choice that they made to go beyond the exact question presented.
So let me put it. And again, to some extent, the question presented is framed by not by the court itself. It's framed by the petitioner. But setting that aside, how? I mean, what strikes me is troubling about the concurrence view, right? Is okay. So then, what does Section 3 mean? And if you can say a state can't enforce this, or a state can't keep a president off candidate off the ballot on the basis of Section 3, or I suppose under any other basis, who can? How does Section 3 work?
Well, Section 3 works. That's a fair question. It's not a question the court had to answer, but if the court wants to take it up, and the court did take it up here, the only other option, the only other avenue would then be through the courts. And that, I don't think that's unreasonable. I mean, the job of the Supreme Court is right to say what the laws, what constitutional provisions mean. There are plenty of parts of the Constitution that are, in fact, self-executing. A good part of the a whole bunch of parts of the 14th Amendment are in fact self-executing. And so this idea that we carve out this exception of self-executing just for this one thing is, I'm not saying that it's that the majority is wrong here, but I tend to be a little more convinced by the three, really, they're not dissenters exactly, but you know what I mean. For instance, for one thing, they point out, well, okay, so the amendment, if you read it, says Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such a disability. Well, they say, you know, it's kind of given that it's kind of hard to understand.
Who can impose it in the first place?
Well,
is the question.
Well, yeah. Well, but here's my, let me finish my thought here. So it's hard to understand why the Constitution would require a supermajority to remove a disqualification if you could just have a simple majority nullify it by repealing legislation. And what I mean here, for instance,
I think that makes sense. Yeah.
So to make this clear, let's say that if we agree that with the, what seems to be the five justices who would say this, that probably six, that the only way that Trump can be declared an insurrectionist and ineligible for a ballot is if Congress passes legislation to that effect. Right. And I think the court agrees that that would be a permissible way, the only permissible way for that to happen. Well, Congress could pass legislation declaring Trump an insurrectionist, but as legislation, it could then be repealed by just a simple majority repealing that legislation and not the 2/3 mentioned in Section 3, because legislation can always be repealed. And so that's the sort of weird note in there. Why would they say that exactly? Why would they put that in? And I think that's a reasonable point to raise.
So let's go to the self-executing piece of this. How can, in our day and age, Section 3 be self-executing? Somebody's got to take him off the ballot or declare that he can't be on the ballot.
Well, yeah, right?
There's got to be some state action that says, whether it's a court, whether it's a secretary of state, whether it's whatever, saying, no, we are taking your name off the ballot. because otherwise, right, of all the requirements to get on the ballot is what you have however many signatures. Now, theoretically, I guess a state could say, and you cannot be convicted of insurrection or something like that. But doesn't that get us back to the same problem of if, you know, could a Colorado court find, and essentially they did, although it wasn't a criminal conviction, right? They found facts that said Trump's an insurrectionist. And if we're saying, well, okay, that's outside of a state's power to do that, I would assume that includes a state court and a state legislature. Then who can?
So I said the federal courts.
Okay.
And so
a federal, so if,
go ahead.
So if a federal court then could determine that someone, now let's walk through that in terms of the self-executing part of it. You're saying you would have to have a federal prosecution that results in a conviction for insurrection or the equivalent thereof.
That the former certainly would satisfy that requirement, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, that would, as I understand the majority's or the per curiam opinion here, that would not be sufficient. So, in other words, Donald Trump, under this ruling,
sure,
could literally be convicted in federal court of insurrection, the crime of insurrection. He would still be eligible to run under this ruling. That seems to me to be bizarre.
Would he, though?
Yeah, I think so.
Here's the thing. Because federal prosecutors don't just have free reign to go around prosecuting people for stuff. They have to have a statute that says this conduct is criminalized. That statute has to be passed by Congress.
And so you're saying that indirectly.
Honestly, I don't know if there's an insurrection crime, or if we call it something else, right? Is it treason? Is it?
I see what you're saying. Okay, so you're saying
sedition?
Would be
is it something else, right?
You could argue that it's sort of indirectly. I don't know. Under my reading of this,
what I'm saying is the federal judiciary and or at least as far as I can tell, right? Now I suppose maybe somebody brings a deck action in federal court saying we want him declared an insurrectionist. But I think that's a problem, too, because I think you have to have some standard, some way of figuring out who is an insurrectionist, who isn't, what counts as insurrection. And to do that, you need a statute. And to do that, you need Congress. So that's where I keep kind of coming back of, well, I think that makes sense. And I think that's a good way to say it. My concern would be, you know, what do you do if after, let's say, Trump is elected? And then you have a new Congress that says we will not recognize him because he's an insurrectionist.
When you say recognize him, what do you mean?
As president.
I mean, what do you mean?
There's going to be this. That someone will make the speech, assuming that the Democrats take the House. Someone will make this motion and make this speech on the House of the floor that that ballot should not be certified because Trump is an insurrectionist.
Well, sure, of course they will do that, but
would a congressional finding be sufficient then to disqualify someone under the Section 3?
I see what you're saying, right? And I think you can make a case that a congressional finding might be sufficient. Again, that's sort of untested territory, right? Talk about wild speculation.
Yeah.
But I guess, and this goes back to my larger point.
That's where I come by. It's like the majority, I think, had it right in that there is some responsibility given what we're looking at to lay out and say, listen, we need actual legislation here.
Yeah. And see, I think, again, this just opens up. It doesn't really answer anything. And it's the court deciding to decide more than it needs to decide. So I am with the Chief Justice of the concurrence in Dobbs on this, is that they did not need to go this far, but they decided to, and I think it was an incorrect decision.
What if they had gone with the president is not an officer of the United States?
I would have.
We both seem to agree on that. Now, I guess there's a question of do you get there? Do you need to get there? I suppose if what the plurality, right, is saying is that, well, no, it doesn't matter. It's just a state thing. And I guess that's the other part that bugs me a little bit, is there didn't seem to be a whole lot of deep legal analysis from the concurrence on the question of why exactly Colorado did is wrong. There seems to be sort of a, you read it and it's kind of like, well, obviously Colorado can't do this because federalism or something, right? There's no.
Well, they agreed with the majority's view in that we can't have this patchwork of things where essentially right. one or two states decides who gets to be president because of the nature of our system and that sort of thing. So, I mean, that's why it was.
But isn't that? I mean, that's what troubles me, is that's a little soft, right? That's a little close to a policy kind of thing of look, we can't hold this way because we don't like the outcome. And I don't care for that. I prefer the, we can't do this because the Constitution doesn't allow it, or the 14th Amendment doesn't authorize it, or something like that, as opposed to just like, well, look, it'd be a real mess if we did that, so we won't.
Yeah. I think
that's kind of sloppy thinking. No offense to the justices. And
I think there was a lot of sloppy thinking, and this was a tough question. And I don't feel that the court, I would not call this a courageous decision in any way, shape or form. Now, I think a decision that would.
No, here's. Yeah. If you want my two cents on just the other internal politics of it, I think this might have been, I think the Chief Justice wanted a unanimous decision. The court did not want to be seen as disqualifying a president. And this was the thing where everybody could get to. And this was the way we could knock it out.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that, in that the court definitely did not want to be seen as disqualifying a president. That would have been horrific. And they were never going to do that. And so, yeah, the internal politics, I also got a sense that there was probably a little, I wouldn't have been surprised if there was a little bit of back and forth to try to get just the Chief Justice over to that side, because he's a sucker for judicial restraint in many instances, and they just couldn't quite pull it off. And so maybe a little bit of, like I said, rancor about that sort of thing. But
one last thing on the self-executing piece, because this does sort of like trouble me, because I think it's just a really tough question to answer. When the 14th Amendment was ratified and took effect, that idea that it is self-executing kind of makes more sense, right? Because you didn't have to have these sort of, I guess, decisions, questions of who's an insurrectionist, who isn't. You know, if Robert E. Lee wanted to run for president, people would say, well, no, he's an insurrectionist. Why? Well, he's wearing a gray uniform and he's marching against, you know, or the United States Army. So no, there was a plain, I don't want to say black line, but a blue gray line of, you knew who an insurrectionist was and who wasn't.
That's a dangerous kind of way. I mean, I see what you're saying here. Yes.
No, I'm just saying when this was drafted, right?
I mean, sure.
It's hard to, and again, I'm a believer in textualism. Right. But you also, it's sort of difficult to divorce what the people who are coming out of this horrific war are thinking, and they've got to, you know what I mean? I guess the idea would be like, when you say insurrection, well, everybody knows what we're talking about. We're talking about this bloodiest war that's lasted the last 5 years, 4 years. Well, at that point, the 14th Amendment was ratified like 68, I think, but drafted during that period. So,
and just,
I guess that's where I'm coming from in terms of, I just don't, I think textually, I don't see a self-executing piece. And I think historically there didn't need to be one, because it was easier. It was sort of self-executing.
Let me have at least one more word on this then, since you wanted to go textualist, that's fine. Section 5 reads, Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. Shall is an important word there if you're a textualist.
Yes.
It did not say must enforce, but shall have the power to enforce. And I think you would agree that's how many other elements of the 14th Amendment have been self-executing, because the existence of Section 5 does not is not a limitation, right? It is, it opens up the possibility, but it is not, that does not restrict provisions of this article to be enforced in other ways. Whereas the court in this instance said, in this one specific case, Congress must, by appropriate legislation, enforce the provisions of that particular part.
So I think that's, that opens a good question into like substantive due process type stuff, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Then, and I think that's probably going to go more than what we'd want to do today. But I think that's sort of the issue, right? Because you would say a lot of these other 14th Amendment rights have been seen as self-executing in the sense of, you know, someone could just, you know, this is an existing right. You can just sue for its breach.
I see where you're going here. You're going down the Clarence Thomas road, and he's right there. He's right there with you. I mean, he's been a big fan of saying this is all just a bunch of garbage and malarkey, and hey, we should just root it out, right? You know,
right. I'm saying that would, and that's intellectually, you can agree or disagree, but it's an intellectually consistent framework in looking at this. You're saying, look, yeah, if Congress now, again, it's also different because, you know, what the 14th Amendment largely did was declare that everybody is a citizen. You know, I mean, it's sort of, you know, and then you get into all this whole like incorporation of various enumerated rights, you know, under the 14th Amendment. But that's a whole other topic and whole other shows we could do on that.
Absolutely.
Whether they're the question for readers who are really into, readers, listeners who are really into this, is whether, you know, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, did that bring in all of these, you know, First Amendment, Fifth Amendment, apply them to the states automatically, or were they selectively sort of incorporated on a case by case basis moving forward? So,
and as you said, that could be an entire.
Yeah.
And so which gets into, again, sort of the jurisprudence of Clarence Thomas, which is certainly consistent, although I would argue, even though I can admire his consistency and in some ways what I would call his intellectual integrity, I oftentimes find myself strenuously disagreeing with sort of his fundamental, where he starts from.
Yeah.
If you accept those fundamentals, then where he often gets to, and many people who see things that way, makes sense. But just because something logically follows doesn't mean it's necessarily something you need to.
I don't know that many people follow that. I mean, a lot of times he's kind of a dissent of one.
I think there's certainly a not insignificant group of people.
Cult following.
maybe more than that, but anyway, so. So anyway, all right. Well, before we end this episode, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the State of the Union, because the buildup was huge. I mean, some people were saying it could be a make or break for Joe Biden. I generally don't put much stock in the State of the Union, but like a lot of people, I wanted to see how Joe Biden looked and how he sounded, because, hey, if he can't get up for something like that, I can't imagine how he's going to successfully navigate, you know, a super strenuous presidential campaign. And okay, aside from my sort of having to be really uncomfortable watching him move around as he got up to the podium a little bit, aside from that, I feel like he did a pretty good job. You know, there were a couple little Biden verbal slip ups, but you could have found stuff like that from the 80s practically. And I felt he was focused. I felt he was, you know, full of piss and vinegar at going at it. And on policy, of course, it's hardly surprising that I almost entirely agree with him, right? I mean, the support for Ukraine stuff, absolutely. The economy's doing well, absolutely. Republicans blocked border legislation, yep. Reproductive rights, I'm right there with you, Joe. Big fan of that new emergency mission. That's one big policy thing, right? To build that pier in the Mediterranean and get humanitarian aid into Gaza. I thought it went pretty well. That was my take on the State of the Union. What do you think, Jay?
So as usual, I didn't watch it just because, you know, well, for a couple reasons, partly justice called elsewhere.
As it does. Right? I mean, so it wasn't like it was bowling night or anything like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Other also, I mean, again, it's horribly long, it's horribly boring, and it's just, you know, getting yelled at by this old man.
Well, Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing her best to try to make it entertaining.
Well, I know. She made it more interesting than usual. So I did see the highlights or lowlights, as it were. And I would say, look, I don't agree with the Marjorie Taylor Greene approach of the heckling. You know, we're not England people, but you know, I tend to be of the opinion, and I think you are too, that it's sort of this almost proto-monarchical kind of spectacle, and my Whiggish soul tends to reject that. So that's, and I think that the test and someone I read that said this is, you know, where will we be on this speech in a week or two, a couple weeks? You know, for example, I'm trying to think of State of the Union speeches that I remember. One would be Bush after 9/11, right? I remember that. There was also a sort of a Clinton, I want to say Clinton 97-ish, a State of the Union that I remember just because it broke like all the records for length, and it was sort of like Fidel Castro's like sitting there looking at his watch going, Jesus, how long is this going to go on?
But I think you're missing the point here. I would argue.
Yeah.
I think you're missing the point in that, of course, there are very few presidents give all kinds of speeches and make all kinds of pronouncements. And any single individual one is almost never going to be. You only get a few, so many, you know, Gettysburg addresses kind of thing. Thank God. Yeah. Given it. But it's part of a larger whole. And that's why I paid much more attention to this one than I'm generally like you on this. But my question, like a lot of Democrats, like a majority of people in my party, is not, does Joe Biden have the right policies? I think pretty much absolutely. Right. He sure as hell does.
Can he even read the teleprompter?
Yeah. And my question is does he, can he convince Americans? Because there's this perception versus reality. I think Joe Biden could be, he's clearly not a super vigorous guy, right? I mean, it feels painful for me to watch him move around and painful for me to watch him at some point read the teleprompter. But I see his, more than his words, his actions. I like what he's done. I like almost all of what he's done. I like the words that he is saying. And sure, it would be great if he were young and vigorous and able to, I don't know, you know, chop down trees and run a mile, what have you. But honestly, this isn't American Ninja Warrior. This is the presidency. And I think Joe Biden is on that ground perfectly fine, but that doesn't matter. What matters is, you know, and there's a big difference, right, between the job of running for president and the job of being president. I think Donald Trump is fantastic at the job of running for president because it's a series of pep rallies, basically. And boy, that's totally in Donald Trump's wheelhouse. But I think there's a freaking just disaster is actually being president. And unfortunately, those two things, there's a different skill set. And right now, Joe Biden just does not have the skill set very well of running for president. But boy, I'll take him any day of the week and twice on Sundays for the skill set of being president over Donald Trump.
Hmm. Well, I would disagree with you on the skill set of being president. You know, again, that's when there's multiple conflicts going on both in Ukraine and in Israel, Gaza, and you can't find your Secretary of Defense for a week and don't even realize he's missing. That's a little troubling. I think the fact that, you know, Biden is sort of kept out of the public eye, I think says something.
Says what? Well, so let's go to that. I'll ignore sort of the shot at the whole Lloyd Austin kind of thing, which could have happened in any administration. But putting that aside, what exactly does keeping him out of the public eye say to you?
It says that there is sort of a lack of confidence amongst his advisors, even, right, in terms of his being able to communicate with the American people. There is things like, for example, we don't know this right yet because we don't have the transcript, but the testimony where on the special counsel's report, where he seemed to be unable to remember things clearly on a number of occasions. There are the other you know, the things of talking about, you know, look, I talked to Mitterrand and so forth. Now, again, we've said this before that, sure, everybody goofs up names every once in a while, or you make verbal mental slips.
Like Donald Trump calling Nikki Haley Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that may have been intentional.
No, it wasn't actually.
But there are a whole lot of these.
That's my point, Joe. That's my point, is that Donald Trump is a great communicator, at least to his base, certainly. He comes at it with energy and verve and enthusiasm, and he connects in a way that Joe Biden doesn't, and visibly in a way that Joe Biden does much less now than he did 4 years ago. But what I am saying is that is not the same thing as
behind closed doors. He's a dynamo.
No, not even being a dynamo. I mean, Calvin Coolidge, from all accounts and Coolidge, was not a dynamo. Right. It's about what decisions you make and how you deliberate over them. And if you are deciding things sort of correctly, and if you can keep a bunch of information in your mind, you know, and for instance, we know, that's why I say about the job of being president, we know from multiple people inside Donald Trump's circle that he was almost allergic to information. He needed to be given pretty pictures and only a few bullet points, and didn't want to know about details of things, and oftentimes was persuaded by whoever happened to be the last person in the room. These are qualities when it comes to actually doing the job that you absolutely do not want in an individual. Whereas from all we know, Joe Biden is focused on detail and has a grasp of these things in a way that Donald Trump never has. And so I'm not talking about policy.
That's why they give him the card telling him which reporters to call on and what they're going to ask.
Again, I think you're conflating two different skill sets.
But isn't that part of being president? I mean, working
Absolutely. I'm absolutely not. I'm not questioning you on that. When it comes to communicating with the American people, Joe Biden does not do a great job of it. I don't think that's part of the job that at his point in his career, he's obviously not going to get better at it, right? He was never awesome at it, and he's just going to get worse, and he has visibly gotten worse. And that, you're right, that is part of the job of president. I would argue that a more important part of the job is making the decisions and taking the actions that make the lives of the American people better. And by that standard, I have every confidence in Joe Biden.
Yeah, well, fair enough. But isn't that sort of the Kent argument, right? That, look, you know, he's right on policy, and he may be a dithering idiot otherwise, but he's, you know, I agree with him on policy, so okay.
Yeah, yes and no. It can get to a point. Like, there was the point with, what, in the Wilson administration, where I think after he had suffered a stroke, and essentially his wife and top advisors were running. That's not okay. Yeah. I mean, if a president is not actually able to process information, is cognitively impaired in some way, where they cannot make those decisions, they're not the one making the final call. When you're routing things, actual policy decisions around the president, because that person doesn't have the intellectual or cognitive capabilities, no. That I would say I would disagree at that point. But
okay.
So I guess
you say we're not there yet.
I don't believe we're there yet. No.
Okay.
That's a fair
answer. Right. I mean, look, I disagree with you, but I think to some extent, it's kind of the same question that you asked me earlier. At what point does at what point is there a moral disqualifier?
Sure.
Right. And the question is, well, could you live with someone who should be morally disqualified but is right on policy?
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah.
And I said, well, again, it depends on the alternative.
Yeah. I guess that I would say for Trump, I would say that not entirely because of age related cognitive decline. Donald Trump just sort of, I don't know, neurologically, temperamentally does not have the cognitive.
I would tend to agree with you. Yes.
Yeah. So there we go.
The disposition.
Yes, there you go. Exactly. Exactly.
The temperament.
Exactly. So, but then again, you say consider the alternative and gotcha. All right.
Yeah.
All right then. Well, why don't we close on that note? And if you're listening, maybe you're a supporter, maybe you're not. We hope if you're not that you consider becoming a supporter. It really does help us out. when you're a supporter. You get ad-free versions of everything we release. You get the full midweek episode instead of just that kind of preview snippet of 10, 15 minutes or so, something like that. And you get access to our Politics Guys Discord group. And like I said, it's been so active lately, so much going on. There's fun stuff, silly stuff, oftentimes really interesting stuff that I wouldn't have thought of. I get a lot out of this group. I think you will too. And you can find out about all of that stuff by going to politicsguys.com/support or patreon.com/politicsguys. That's too many links, but just go into the show notes. You'll see how to support the show. And whether you're a supporter or not, it's a huge thing, us getting reviews and ratings on podcast apps. And so if you haven't done that, it only takes a minute or two. We would really, really appreciate it if you could do that. And finally, as always, a very special thanks to our amazing executive producers. They are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.